The number of people living with cancer in the United States is on the rise. A recent report from the National Cancer Institute estimated 14 million people in the United States have a cancer diagnosis, but that number is expected to grow to 19 million by 2024. And at the same time, cancer treatment today is mostly given in outpatient treatment centers. This means someone is needed to be part of the day-to-day care of the person with cancer. Anyone who steps into the role of caregiver for a loved one with cancer, whether in a shared or full-time role, can find it's not always easy to know what to say and do. And the person with the cancer diagnosis may be unskilled in knowing how to ask for or accept help. Today we have as our guest Dr. Stan Goldberg. He's a professor emeritus of communicative disorders at San Francisco State University and author of the new book, Loving, Supporting, and Caring for the Cancer Patient. He's a prolific award-winning writer, editorial consultant, and recognized expert in the area of cancer support, end-of-life issues, caregiving, chronic illnesses, aging, and change. It's our delight to have on the program today to help talk about this difficult issue, Dr. Stan Goldberg. Hi, Stan.
Hi, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah. I read your book. It's very good, and it helps a lot with communication with cancer patients. You know, I think that when someone hears the word cancer with respect to them, their whole world goes upside down. So much fear, uncertainty, and everything. It's absolutely necessary to have as much help for that person as possible. Why did you get into this form of taking care of people and helping them?
Well, it stemmed from my own diagnosis of prostate cancer, which was 13 years ago. And at the time of the diagnosis, the prognosis was not very clear. The urologist said that he knew it was aggressive, and essentially he would have to wait until surgery to figure out just how much it had spread. Unfortunately, it had spread, and I knew at that point that I would have to live with my cancer forever. And that really brought to light for me the difficulty not only that I was having in accepting the diagnosis, but in how other people, including family, reacted to me. And that started a 13-year journey, which included caring for people in hospice, many of whom had cancer, and obviously all of them who were terminal. So that was the impetus. That's how it all started 13 years ago.
And in this book, you talk about five approaches to supporting your loved one with cancer. Let's go over those. The first one is actions are better than words.
Yeah, and this one actually was interesting because I learned this from the first time someone said to me, I have cancer. It was a very good friend and, who was always very healthy, and she called and she said, I have cancer. And I struggled with what to say and do. And basically, I said what maybe 85% of everybody else says, and that is, I'm so sorry to hear about that. And I felt at a loss of, I expressed my condolences, but where do I go from there? And so I started looking at what was helpful and what wasn't, and I talked to hundreds of cancer patients, people that I cared for, and people who were friends and, but had a cancer diagnosis. And what everyone said to me, it was a resounding theme, is don't worry about the words that you use. It's more important to do actions that convey the compassion that you have. And so when I say that actions are more important than words, I don't mean that you shouldn't convey condolences, but be prepared to do something that will show the compassion that you have.
So when she said, "I have cancer," and you said, "I'm so sorry to hear that," your next line would have been, "What can I do to help you?"
Even more specific than that, it would have been, "Okay, I know that you're, for example, I know that you're having chemotherapy on Wednesday, and I know that's going to make you very weak. I'll come over on Thursday to help you shop or clean your house. Tell me what time to be there." That specificity I found from people that I spoke to and my own experience was very important. You know, unless someone is specific about what they're prepared to do, often a cancer patient feels that, you know, that they're just saying something that's obligatory. So it's very important to be specific.
Right. Well, it's a very difficult issue from all people involved. It's a life-changing time when the doctor says you have cancer. Well, let's go on to the second point. He says, stay flexible on any engagements.
Yeah. What I found in my own life and the life of the people that I counseled was that, you know, coping with cancer is almost like walking on a bowl of Jell-O. You know, there's very little that's stable. If you have an active cancer, things keep changing. What you were able to do yesterday, you can't do today. What you're able to do today, you may not be able to do tomorrow. And for the cancer patient, they know that implicitly. You know, they know that things are changing sometimes very dramatically. What's difficult, though, is for their loved one to understand what that instability does to the cancer patient's life. And that's why, you know, I counsel people who are caregivers that they have to remain flexible. You know, you can't expect because your loved one said they're, you know, would be able to take a walk this evening, that that's actually going to happen. You know, and so flexibility is, I think, is critical.
Yes. What is the difference that you found in how a person reacts based on his or her spiritual development as opposed to a person who doesn't believe in a hereafter and a person who does? How do those cancer patients relate when you talk to them?
Well, you know, I had an expectation before I started work in hospice and counseling caregivers that the greater the spirituality, the easier it would be to accept, you know, a possible journey towards death. And I found that I couldn't make any gross generalizations. I was with people who were devout Catholics who, you know, even though the liturgy suggested that confession was really all that was needed or one of the main components for having a peaceful ending, that it didn't necessarily work for them. And I also dealt with people who were agnostics who were very peaceful in the journey. In terms of what makes for an easier acceptance of, let's say, a terminal diagnosis, spirituality, I think, is important, but there's also other issues that made it difficult or less difficult. And these were things such as regrets the person had their entire life, things that they felt they could not be forgiven for. And while some people found comfort in their religion, others couldn't, and vice versa. So it gets to be very complicated. At least I found it very complicated to make any generalizations.
Do you think that in a hospice-type situation that it is helpful to try to find out from the person where they are at spiritually?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I mean, that's real critical. One of the things that happens in hospice is we try to compassionately support a person's journey. And sometimes that means going with their view of life that's different, and death, that's different than yours. You know, the idea is you are witnessing their journey. So I've by understanding what the extent of a person's spirituality, it guides me. It, at least in the past, I had to stop doing hospice because of illness. But it guides me in providing a pathway for them. You know, I've had patients who were devout Baptists whose view on spirituality I didn't necessarily accept as my own, but by understanding what it was, I could help them. And it's the same with someone with no religious or spiritual beliefs. Understanding that can also help me guide them through the process.
Okay, before we go on with these issues, tell our audience, if you would, how to get a copy of this really great book,
Loving, Supporting, Caring. The book's title is Loving, Supporting, and Caring for the Cancer Patient. It has not been released yet, but it will be released October, 16th. And it's available on Amazon or any of the other online booksellers.
Great. Okay, now we're going to get back to the approaches to supporting your loved one with cancer. And the third point I wanted to ask you about was, keep in mind that pain is subjective. I know when I go to the VA, everybody on their staff says, on a scale of 1 to 10, what is your pain today? Mm-hmm. That's the most common thing that they ask you. Tell us about pain.
Well, I think most people who've never experienced pain, and I imagine there are some people, so most people who have never experienced excruciating pain have a notion that you can think of pain as having a beginning and an ending point. The pain comes on, medication is given, and hopefully the medication will stop the pain. But people who have chronic pain think of it very differently. For them, there is an anticipation of the pain. Like, I know that if I have to get out of bed and use the toilet, the act of, you know, of moving my legs will cause me pain. So I can be sitting there comfortably, and I'm still thinking about it. I get up, I do the action, I'm in pain, I lay back down again, the pain stops. Well, I'm not done with pain because I'm now going to anticipate the next time I have to get up. So this rather porous boundaries between the onset and the ending of pain is something that's pervasive in the life of many cancer patients. And it could be due to the actual cancer or the therapeutic protocol that's being used. So the person who is caring for the cancer patient needs to have that understanding that oftentimes the anticipation of the beginning of a pain or the anticipation of its reoccurrence can be more devastating psychologically than the actual pain itself.
I think the definition of hospice has something to do with making a determination of how long the doctor thinks the patient will live. Is that right?
Yeah. The way that the current rules, I guess their Medicare rules are set up, is that that a physician has to certify that in their minds a patient has 6 months or less to live. And, I've never spoken to a physician who was able to say, yes, with certainty, this is the amount of time a person has to live. Oftentimes, the determination of that amount of time involves compassion. You know, if I'm a physician and I'm with a patient who I'm not really sure how long they're going to live, but I can see that would definitely benefit from the compassion showed in hospice, I might be more apt to certify to say, yes, this person has 6 months, rather than to say, well, definitively, I can't tell. So I think physicians have gotten a lot better about that, and they've also gotten a lot better about recommending hospice much earlier than they used to.
Okay, so the reason I brought that up was you've done hospice before, and if you had a patient in a hospice situation and everything, would you feel like that there was anything wrong with addicting them to a pain medication?
You know, in the 8 years that I've done hospice, I've never seen a situation where someone became addicted to the pain medication. The amount of opiates that are necessary to manage the pain most likely would cause addiction to someone not in hospice. When someone is dealing with that amount of pain, I've never seen even very high dosages of opiates lead to any addiction. And even if it did, you know, hypothetically, even if it did, you know, we're looking at balancing two issues. One is an addiction or a dependence upon a drug, and the other is the reduction of pain that sometimes is excruciating. So it's, for me, most issues of choice have to do with compassion. What's the compassionate thing to do?
Well, I'm going to throw in my little testimony here, and I agree with you. There's a difference between taking a narcotic to get high and taking a narcotic to get rid of bad pain. I had bad sciatica, and the doctors were kind of fumbling around before they actually decided to operate on me. And a six-month period went by there that in order to get out of bed and to do anything productive, they had me on Dilaudid, 2 milligrams every hour or two.
Mm-hmm.
That's a pretty high dose of a
absolutely
strong narcotic. But when they finally operated on me, and I got up out of bed the same day, I didn't have that sciatic pain again, and I never took another narcotic.
Mm-hmm.
So I understand what you're saying, and I agree with it, that if that's the case, and because that's the case, I think that the compassionate thing to do is make the patient comfortable, whatever
exactly
whatever it takes.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, maybe some of your listeners don't know about a thing called palliative care specialists. These are physicians whose specialty is the reduction of pain, and they're very sophisticated about when to use narcotics and how much to use and these kinds of issues. So if any of them is not satisfied with the care they're receiving in terms of pain, they should seek out a palliative care specialist.
And these are generally hospital-based physicians, right?
Not necessarily. Some are in the hospital. Some are associated with hospices. But there are also some private practitioners. And I think the number of them is increasing.
Okay. Your fourth point that we need to get to today is wait for your loved one to initiate difficult discussions.
Yeah. One thing that I learned, you know, one of the things that I was always concerned about when I first started hospice was, do I talk about death to someone, you know, who obviously knows they're dying, or do I wait? And one of the things that I learned very quickly is that when it comes to difficult conversations, whether it's dealing with one's own death or accepting changes in identity because of the cancer, that until the person is ready to have that discussion, bringing it up usually results in defensive reactions. So in the 8 years that I did hospice, I never once brought up the topic of death. But in virtually every one of the patients I had, they all brought it up when it was time. So I would encourage people not to necessarily avoid talking about difficult issues. And there's a number of difficult issues involved with cancer. But get a sense of when your loved one is ready to do that.
Okay. You said number five, go along with any decisions that the patient is going to make.
Yeah, it's really hard, as I've found, not only for my patients, you know, clients that I serve, but also my own family, to go along with a decision someone makes about their treatment protocol. I had a brother-in-law with brain cancer, and after one surgical procedure, he found something on the internet, which to me was absolutely ludicrous, but for him was his last best chance of living. And I was faced with, what am I going to do with this? You know, how am I going to support him? This was a ridiculous approach. But I knew that saying, this is a ridiculous approach, you know, would do nothing more than make him depressed and have him more re-entrenched in that decision. And, you know, I ended up being supportive of his decision without implying that I agreed with it. And you know, of course, it was not successful, and he died shortly afterwards. But it's those kinds of choices that I think caregivers face continually. You know, do I support this decision even though I don't agree with it? And an even more difficult situation occurs when the decision of your loved one is to forego treatment and allow the cancer to progress.
Why don't you give us a brief overview of how your book is set up?
Well, the way that I looked at it is, what are the different kinds of stages? And when I say stages, I really don't mean like a Kubler-Ross stages. But what happens as someone is diagnosed with cancer? What things are necessary? So the first thing I talk about is, there's a section on basics. You know, what do you need to know? Some of the very fundamentals about living with cancer. That's followed by a section on what happens when a diagnosis is made. You know, the person who is diagnosed with cancer has to make some fundamental decisions. Who do I tell, and how do I tell them that? The next section looks at how cancer affects one's life. And for me, it's a lifetime of uncertainty. You know, I don't know how long I will live. I don't know if what I'm able to do today, I can still do tomorrow. And that changes one's personality and one's view of the world. The next section has to do with losses. One of the things that's pretty universal with most cancer is that people suffer losses. It can be the loss of feelings of safety. It can be the loss of a specific skill. For me, I wasn't able to do certain things that had defined my life. So it's trying to enable the caregiver to understand how losses affect one's personality. The next session has to do with conversations. You know, we all hope that we are good communicators. What I've found is we probably are not as good as we think we are. And as a result, there are certain things that can be done to make those conversations not only more honest, but more meaningful. The next section has to do with pain. And we talked about the understanding that pain really has porous boundaries. And some suggestions there on what a caregiver can do to reduce the effect of pain. The next section has to do with easing a loved one's death. And that's the section nobody wants to have to read. But with the statistics, it's, you know, pretty important that we do understand how to help a loved one die. And a lot of the things there come from my 8 years' experience in hospice. And the final section has to do with recovering joy. You know, we spent this whole book now talking about all of these terrible things involved with cancer because no one else wants to talk about them. But there also has to be an understanding of what a loved one can do after the loss of a friend or a relative. And that section looks at some very specific strategies that can be used to recover joy.
We've been talking today with Dr. Stan Goldberg, and his book is called Loving, Supporting, and Caring for the Cancer Patient. And it will be available, mid-October?
Yes, October 16th.
October 16th, and you can get it at any of your online companies, Amazon, or you can ask your bookstore to order it for you. Stan, it's been really nice to have you on the program today and talking about this this issue, and the program is called Share Your Mission, so I'm going to ask you, what do you think is your mission in life right now?
I think it has to do with conveying information, how to deal with people with severe illnesses that I've been able to accumulate, not through any innate ability of my own, but by having patients share with me what they've experienced and what helped and what didn't help.
Well, that's a great mission, and I wish all the success in the world and a long life to be able to accomplish that.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Stan Goldberg, and the book is called Loving, Supporting, and Caring for the Cancer Patient. Thanks again for being on the program today, Stan.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.